I think that culture can be defined in a lot of different ways. You know, we talk about geographic culture, and then we talk about Kodiak food culture overall. And of course, we're an island here, and so we need shelf-stable products that can last the journey. But there's a lot of other facets to food systems that people sometimes forget, or it's a little too daunting to think about. And there's a lot of consumer guilt, right? When you talk about food, consumers are faced with hundreds of purchasing decisions every day, or just consumption decisions. And so if you have something that's quick and easy and affordable, that's right in front of your face, of course, that's what we're going to choose. Because if we were all faced with the decision calculus of going through every single decision every day and making down the pros and cons list, you know, we would get nothing done. So of course, Coke and chips often seem like a really good decision. And I think that when you break food, the way we were talking at the open forum about food culture and food sovereignty and ownership of a food system, it takes place up and down the value chain, right? So you have food production, you have food transport, so you have your supply chain, and then at the end consumption stage, you have food policy, so, and that actually permeates throughout the rest of the food value chain. So there's production, policy, supply chain, and then there's education. So you can put as many vegetables in front of people as you want, but if they don't know how to prepare it, or they're not incentivized to prepare it, and by incentive, I mean time and access to fresh food, then it does not matter how much kale we have in Kodiak. People aren't going to eat it. And there's a study. So one of my other jobs for this food sovereignty report is aggregating data that's already been collected, obviously, so I don't have to do a lot of double duty. And a great quote that came out of a previous study was someone talking about how much they really want low cost for food access. And so I think the quote, here it is. But if I can get 6 cans of pineapple for the price of 1 pound of local kale, I won't be buying the kale. And I think that pretty much sums up what I'm finding from everyone. Everybody on Kodiak has been amazing about giving me at least 5 minutes to talk about food and what they think about food systems and what food security means to them and food sovereignty and food access. And cost is definitely the first point that comes up. Everyone's like, yes, life on Kodiak is expensive. Another great quote that I heard was someone said, I said, do you think food is too expensive? And they were like, well, food here costs probably about as much as it should for having traveled 3,000 miles. So we're far away. People know that. But how do you do that? Maybe you make more food locally.
Mm-hmm. So could you talk to me a little bit about your background in studying this? Because I know you've been brought in as a consultant kind of on this project, which is a gigantic project and one that people really value here, it seems. So could you talk a little bit about your assignment, your background?
Sure. So I was brought in with CANA, Kodiak Area Native Association, to do this food sovereignty assessment. And I originally met with Tyler Cornelis at the, March 2016 Alaska Food Policy Council Conference. And food systems has been at least tangentially related in my career for a while now. I grew up making food and gardening food in Ohio with my mom. You know, it was one of those from a very tiny age. I was in the garden with my grandparents and, you know, eating peas and tomatoes. And it sort of became ingrained in me. And then I think it really started to, I really started to work purposefully on food when I went to the Peace Corps. So after undergrad at Kent State in Ohio, I left and went to Benin, West Africa, where I lived in a pretty rural village for 2.5 years. And I worked on dry season gardening initiatives and also local nutritional education for nursing moms and people who were ill and babies and toddlers. So people who were the most vulnerable in food scarce communities. So I did that and learned a lot about how much I didn't know about food and how complicated it is to sell nutrition as, you know, a super sexy message, right? Coca-Cola feels mm-hmm. great as a brand, and that's why everyone wants it. But, you know, getting all your vegetables is a much harder message to make sexy to people. So learned a lot about that. I ended up leaving Peace Corps at the end of my service, and I commercial fished in Dutch for a couple winters and learned a lot more about what I don't know about seafood in North America. And that was really eye-opening for the resources we have and how we protect our resources and what other economies around the world do as well.
It's such an interesting arena because it's so big and there are so many things that different cultures do that we could tap into that maybe, again, is a cultural issue. Like, I'm not sure if the culture you went to when you were in Peace Corps did this at all, but I know insects are eaten widely in other parts of the country. Like tarantulas, I can't exactly remember in what country, but
many
countries.
Many.
I was deep-fried tarantulas, which again, there's an issue there, deep-frying things. We're not sure about that, but if it's a protein,
yeah,
get it however you can.
The insect wave has really started to hit developed countries, but you know, people have been eating insects since people have been eating food. You mm-hmm. know, they're a fantastic source of protein. I don't know about tarantula chips, but
I'd eat it.
I would at least try it. Traveling a lot through Southeast Asia, you know, I saw baskets and baskets of bugs at markets, and it was a staple in the diet. And in a lot of different parts of Africa where I traveled, obviously very unique, independent cultures, but a lot of folks were eating insects, and it was normed. What I've seen in North America is grinding insects into a powder, so more mm-hmm. of a fortified product. So we're not directly eating bugs because people still can't really, for lack of a better term, stomach it. Sorry. it's hard and it doesn't feel very good, but it is an alternative source of protein.
Yeah, for sure. And when you were exploring those countries, what kind of bugs were they eating?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I'm not a bug specialist.
Do they look appetizing?
No, not.
And again, it's kind of like kale. You got to, like, be able to do something with it. It won't look appetizing if it's just, like, in its raw form. It's kind of like Brussels sprouts, where it's just, like, either it's a Brussels sprout or it's, like, a nicely toasted ball of goodness.
With some balsamic drizzled all over it. Yeah, if it was, you know, roasted crickets that were perfectly crunchy with maybe some balsamic over it, I would probably be more inclined than, you know, just a basket full of them.
I've had crickets, and they were very dry. There was no seasoning. So it's like anything. It's not, bugs aren't going to be a naturally yummy dessert or food or whatever. Although I've heard some are. Saw that in Bizarre Foods. But you gotta do something with it.
Yeah, I think hot sauce goes a long way.
Hot sauce.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like make them spicy like chips, and they got the crunch in there. For instance, when I was in Chinatown in New York, I had some chicken legs, and that involves like sucking the skin off the bones. But the sauce was so good. I don't know what they put in there. It was just like I could have eaten the sauce on anything. So I think it's really what you do with it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure we're going to be introducing insects to Kodiak anytime soon.
I feel like it's just going to take one food truck. Somebody needs to stand up and say, this is it.
That would be amazing. That would be, I feel like doing that right now. Copyright DeRoche, because, because I looked it up online and I saw that they had grasshoppers powdered down into a powder. Mm-hmm. You could make cupcakes out of that, and you could make it, like, you could make it insect themed or not. You could just be like, oh, we're just like a very subtle dessert. And we have...
It's fortified.
It would be so protein. Novel. And people, I think people would buy it because it's just the shock of it. In fact, I feel like doing this right now. I'm not going to air this at all.
Right, cricket cakes? Go.
I'm going to do it. But to bring it back a little bit to Kodiak, when you first found this project, what were your thoughts?
That it's daunting. I think that this is not something, you know, this is not something I'm working on in a vacuum and just aggregating reports and typing out my thoughts about it. This is something that takes a lot of community engagement, a lot of community surveying. We have some previous surveys and reports that have been done on the island, but I do have an individual food consumer survey that we're going to be posting on the Kodiak Co-op Facebook page. And we're going to be hopefully distributing throughout the island digitally as well. And I do have paper copies. So it takes a lot of personal input from people. Again, everyone here has an opinion about food. And what I need to do is get all that information together to make it say something. So I guess my first thought was, wow, that's a big project. Okay, let's do this. Oh, geez, who do I talk to? And that's what I've been doing here. And I was here in December as well for a focus group, and people have been very gracious with their time at all levels. So I need to meet with people from government, people from all cultural groups represented here, the retailers. You know, they have a stake in this. Everyone on Kodiak is a food system stakeholder. There's nobody here who is not affected by access to food or lack thereof.
Mm-hmm. Well, some of the terminology can be a little daunting. So what is a food system? Let's talk about it.
Yeah, this is where it gets mucky. So there's a lot of food vocabulary. And at the basic consumer level, we all know about food labels, right? And so everyone here has talked about, do we want organic? Do we want fresh? Do we want local? And what do those words mean? What does natural mean? And then as you move up the value chain, there's different kind of families of vocabulary. So a food system in my brain and the way that it has been represented is that it's kind of like a big web. So it's not linear and it's very layered, but in, you know, it's a web. And so everything, when you move any part of the system or you affect any part of the system, it permeates and shakes out through the rest of the system. So changing something on the supply end absolutely affects your end consumer. And that's the way that I like to think about it, because it is complicated, it is messy, and it should feel like a big topic to swallow. Again, sorry for the food pun.
I think we should have more food puns.
I mean,
like,
stop.
Keep on giving it. I love it. Have you found that food systems vary widely from community to community, or is it kind of similar within Alaska rural communities?
Well, so the concept of food security doesn't really waver. Food security is having enough food that is appropriate for you at any time you want it. And that means financial access as well as physical access. Food sovereignty, people's perception of their right to food, how they feel they own their own food system, definitely varies from community to community. And that's how you culturally identify with certain foods, your preparation rituals, which is, by that I just mean cooking. Every single community defines that differently. And that's even within Kodiak, right? So All of our village communities here, Port Lyons, food sovereignty looks different than Kodiak proper.
Mm-hmm. Could you go back to food sovereignty and explain that?
Yeah. So food sovereignty is a people's right to food, and it's people's perception and how they define it. And that's a big thing that I'm doing here, is gauging people's perception of their right to food. And someone, I think, said it really well when I was here in December. I was like, what does food sovereignty mean to you? And he said, well, it's that I can eat what I want when I want. And I was like, boom, done. So, and that's the essence of it. However, you know, we can put a ton of vocabulary around it. We can dress it up, but it's having, it's that you feel in control of your own food decisions.
Mm-hmm. How do we find an even balance between the price of food and the right to food? Because that seems like the biggest barrier when you can't even afford the best food for your body. How do you have a right to it?
This is, to me, one of the most important but most complicated questions in analyzing food systems today. I think that we all understand that people could vote with their dollar, right? You buy better products, you encourage local production. That's wonderful. The reality in many communities around the nation and the world is that people can't vote with their dollar. And if you look at a household budget, food is the most flexible or most elastic line item. Your rent is fixed, your insurance is fixed, your cell phone bill is often fixed. But food you can save on by buying lower cost items, which are often lower. They have a lower, they're not as good for you. Their nutritional impact is not as good for you. So I think that, the price conversation is necessary to have. People are talking about the Kodiak Food Co-op as a potential new point of access to lower cost food for people in the community. And that's something that they're very cognizant of. We don't need another Whole Foods here. We don't need another a boutique, you know, a food boutique. That's not what is going to serve the greater population and increase access to better food. Mm-hmm. So I think that your question is valid, and I don't have a good answer for it.
Well, let's talk about prices for a second, because as far as groceries, I would say Kodiak is about the same prices as Anchorage, give or take, especially if we have sales. So, for instance, I went to Anchorage and I bought some kind of rice thing. It was a cornmeal or something like that. And I came back to Kodiak and I saw that it was the exact same price on sale. So I would say it's about the same price. And then you look at junk food versus, for instance, frozen vegetables. And this is just something that stands out in my mind because I just bought frozen vegetables. But, for instance, like a deal of two chips for $5, we have thousands of calories of things that will just go through your system and do not amazing things in large quantities. And then we have vegetables. Maybe you can make one or two meals out of the amount of like $2 of a frozen vegetable pack. So, like, what do you have to say about that?
Oh boy. You know, we eat like that because, well, for so many reasons, we want our bellies to be full. That's what people want in general when they eat food. That's the value you get out of it, is that you feel good, you feel full, and it serves a purpose. It gives you energy. Obviously, with food technology, we have plenty of products that do that, that don't really resemble food in its natural state. So protein bars rather than eating a piece of meat or a piece of fish or you know, a bowl of beans, things like that. So I think that I don't think you can have that conversation either without talking about food assistance programs and people who are on SNAP and WIC benefits, and what they have access to as well. Because you can only go grocery shopping so many times as a family, regardless on if you're on food assistance or not. You know, you can only go to the store so many times a week. I hate going to the grocery store. And so if I go once a week, it's wonderful if I can get everything in one stop. In Anchorage, we have the luxury of having fresher produce than you do in Kodiak. And so while the prices are the same, I think that the quality can be difficult to achieve here, just simply because of distance. And it's often not the fault of any retailer. It just is hard to get spinach to keep for 15 days from the field to point of sale. Which I think is often a turnoff for people. My partner grew up in a lot of places in rural Alaska, and he has serious vegetable aversion. Anytime, you know, our cauliflower or broccoli starts to look the littlest bit of brown, he's like, okay, we're done. Nope, we can't. We're not eating that. And there's a little, we're doing education in the home as well. But I think that that turns a lot of people off because we want perfect produce. That's what's marketed to us. And it's just often not a reality out here.
Mm-hmm. And I'm also saying, like, junk food is pretty expensive. So people have a tendency to want to buy chips, whereas the veggies aren't so much more expensive, but they are more expensive than, say, the middle of Wisconsin, buying from your neighbor, the farmer, Farmer Joe. And I come from New York, so the comparison here, I'm not used to cheap vegetables. But also, you brought up protein bars, which is kind of interesting because that's another, it seems, you can tell me if it's not, another food system. It fits into the health, like, market, and yet there's a lot of added sugar in some of those. It doesn't have a lot of volume, so it won't fill you up. You're kind of relying on the protein to fill you. So there's another set of values that people hold where they make protein shakes. And for me, that wouldn't work out. I need a lot of volume and water and veggies to, like, make me feel full. So protein bars for me would be a trap, but that's part of another culture that's in there, a health foods marketing culture.
And individual preference.
Yeah.
Right? Some people do not care at all about protein consumption for fitness. Some people absolutely have to drink 4 protein shakes a day. And it is individual preference. And it's for whatever, like you said, whatever culture they ascribe to.
Right. And are you familiar with any of the documentaries out there? Like, I saw this one documentary, I think he was British, but he ate just tons of sugar every day. Do you know this one?
Super Size Me?
No, that's actually McDonald's. He would eat tons of McDonald's. And I think that it kind of inspired tons of similar documentaries. This one was about a young guy. He decided he would eat for like 40 grams of sugar per day. And, you know, he was going to doctors. He was like, okay, we're going to monitor my progress so I don't die spontaneously. But the rule was that he couldn't eat junk food. He had to eat added sugar that was in like normal foods, like that you wouldn't expect to be there. Like barbecue sauce. I don't know exactly, but, like cereal, for instance. Mm-hmm. So that's the way that he tested this hypothesis that there's too much added sugar, invisible sugar in our foods. So that's another danger of processed food.
Processed foods are a double-edged sword. They are shelf-stable, and they are a great thing to take on, to take on trips or for populations who need access to food right away, or places where we need to store food for a long time because there's a potential of a disaster or an emergency where our supply chain is going to be cut off, kind of like Kodiak. So processed foods are a fantastic innovation if they are used for good. Yeah. I think that that's the key, is that it's such a powerful tool if we don't exploit it or overuse it, which is where we're seeing, this is what we're seeing in our culture today, is that we are overusing the power of processed foods.
Because it is exploited. And there was an interview in this documentary with a scientist who was funded by like Pepsi Cola or something like that. And he's like, well, everything in moderation. It's like, yeah, but you're not going to be moderate with soda. If you're a big soda drinker, you could just knock that back. And there's so much sugar in soda. And
well, and I think your point, soda often is, I mean, and soda is demonized often, especially in documentaries and food literature, because it's, you know, kind of it's like you're snorting lines of sugar. It's an immediate intake. But like you said, in cereals and other foods that we eat every day that we don't necessarily associate with sweetness or candy or a treat, there's a ton of added sugar. And so there are some pretty bad offenders that we just don't consider. Cereals getting a much closer look, I think, by some watchdogs, especially for kid marketing, you know, marketing to kids, delicious sugary cereal. Is that ethical or not? You know, that's up for discussion. But I think there's that goes into consumer education again, right? And consumer ownership. And we should be able to eat whatever we want if we have a truly food sovereign system, and that takes the consumer making choices about what to eat and about their own personal health.
Yeah, and being informed, because not everyone understands what added sugar does or that it's bad, especially a lot of health products are touted as being healthy, and they have, like, even some of the healthier cereal brands I can think of, and I did a no sugar thing a while ago, and I'm still kind of doing it.
Do you feel good?
Yeah, no, I feel good. I've never eaten a lot of added sugar anyway, but some of the healthy brands I was looking at, because I was looking for an alternative, was like 7 to 14 grams of added sugar per serving, and I'm like, even that is too much. If I'm eating a lot of fruit in the day, like, I don't need added sugar to my diet. So you can always go with like just whole wheat kinds of cereals. I mean, it's not the same kick as you're going to get if you've grown up on sugar-filled cereals. So that's where it's missing. That's where
Well, that's part of it. I think that our tastes, you know, sugar is an acquired taste, but boy, we acquire it really quickly. And the ancient part of our brain really wants the sugars and the fats, because we evolved to really store that and to seek it out. That's why it's so tasty to us. But I think part of the conversation too around, back to the value added and processed and shelf stable foods, those often have a lot of sugar added to them, but those are also aspirational foods. And so those are foods that you buy when you have some extra cash, or foods that you, if you have the choice, you will buy because it feels better. It feels like you're buying something, again, back to the sexy branding of Coca-Cola, right? So like Doritos feels great. Food branding feels great to look at. It's amazing. But, you know, the education component is often not there.
Yeah. Whenever I go to parties, I always bring the on-brand stuff. Like, I never eat Oreos. They're not sponsoring us, you guys, but I never eat Oreos. But I bring them to parties all the time because people like eat them up. Because it's crazy. Like, more than when I bring wine, more than when I bring like cookies, the Oreos just go really fast at parties. So I always bring the junkiest of the junk food.
It's a party. It's a celebration.
Yeah.
And Oreos, you know, hush, hush. They feel great. I love eating them. I never eat them, but when I do.
I mean, I love them. That's why I don't keep them in the house.
Exactly.
So could we talk a little bit about what you heard from people who went to the Kodiak event this week?
Yeah, the open forum that we had at the Kodiak building. We went through, and this is something that I could have talked for years with these folks about, but we had an hour and a half. So we did what we could. We had about 20 members from the community show up from all walks and all backgrounds, and that was really encouraging to see, knowing that everyone is engaged, at least they're paying attention to their food system. And we did an exercise where we went through the seven tenets or the seven principles of food sovereignty, and it includes things like how does the community hold their food sacred? What's their relationship with food? And do you value local producers? And is food cost effect, is it financially accessible? So we broke up into several groups, and each of the groups went through and talked about how these principles were or were not represented on Kodiak. And it was really interesting that some groups just jumped right in, and one group got so far as to redefine the entire work week. You know, they said that if we're going to truly value food in our community, we need to go down to a 3-day-a-week work week, and everyone needs to start gardening. And they set the bar pretty high for conversation. But then we made that a little more realistic, and other groups jumped in and said, well, wait a minute, that's not so crazy. You know, a lot of us are gardeners, and a lot of us have surplus food, and a lot of us like to barter. And so when you're gardening and you're sharing it with people, you're sharing that culture as well, not just food. And there was a gentleman there who didn't have access to any land to garden, but he did have a lot of friends who gardened. And he talked about the power of them calling him up and saying, hey, you know, are you out of vegetables? Great. Bring your coveralls. Come on over. You're going to work, but you're going to go home with a bag of vegetables. And I think that really speaks to the heart of the Kodiak community. People here definitely know how to work hard. I'm hoping that in the food system here, we can work a little smarter and figure out a way to produce a little bit more and get it into more mouths and bellies.
Do you have any ideas?
I have so many ideas. I think for as many people as are on Kodiak, there are, you know, 10 or 12 ideas of how to increase access to food. The big ones that we keep seeing are we going to continue to be beholden to a transportation system to deliver food, or are we going to focus on investing resources to grow more here? That's kind of the fork in the road that we're at. My job is to develop ideas around opportunities for each of those areas and what that looks like. And that's what I'll be primarily spending the next 3 months researching and looking at other examples around the world and what other resource-scarce and rural communities have done.
And producing a report on that.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that's due out. The Kodiak Region Food Sovereignty Assessment is due out the end of August of this year.
And what's the goal of the report, the assessment?
The goal of the report is to figure out our baseline. So where are we at? We are looking at the costs and implications of food system breakdown. So what happens if the boat doesn't come in and continues to not come in? Opportunities for food production and people's perception of food access right now.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. This is great. If people have any other questions or they'd like to have a conversation, you can contact me at eatwellkodiak@gmail.com, and happy to have a conversation with anyone.